Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The climate summit begins in Paris, and U.S. President Barack Obama urged world leaders at the U.N. climate summit to seek more advances in the fight against global climate change.
Our task here in Paris is to turn these achievements into an enduring framework for human progress.
Mr. Obama said leaders share a sense of urgency about their goal of curbing fossil fuel emissions and limiting the rise in global temperatures. U.S. officials are urging Russia and Turkey to tone down their rhetoric, worried the growing dispute over last week's shootdown of a Russian fighter plane by Turkey could increase conflict in an already embattled region. Turkey and Russia appeared to harden their stances Monday. Following a NATO meeting on Monday in Brussels, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoglu said his country will not apologize for shooting down the Russian plane. Russian President Vladimir Putin refused to meet with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The International Monetary Fund Monday added China's currency to its basket of key global currencies. Here is Managing Director Christine Lagarde.
Today, November 30th, the IMF's Executive Board decided that the renminbi qualified for the SDR basket under existing criteria.
The yuan will be added to the list that includes the U.S. dollar, Europe's euro, the Japanese yen, and the British pound as one of the currencies in the World Organization's special drawing rights grouping. The action takes place next October. The Burkina Faso Electoral Commission says Roch Marc Christian Kabore has won the presidential election in that country. It says the turnout was about 60%. This is VOA News. The United States tightened its visa waiver program Monday in the wake of the Paris terrorist attacks. It added new screenings for travelers headed to the U.S. from the 38 countries whose citizens need a visa to enter the country. The White House says the country's Homeland Security Agency is immediately altering its electronic visa-free clearance system to capture information on whether U.S.-bound travelers have made any trips to countries the United States considers to be a terrorist safe haven. In addition, the U.S. government said it is considering pilot programs to add the use of biometric screening for travelers. British Prime Minister David Cameron has called for a debate and a vote in Parliament on Wednesday on whether Britain should launch airstrikes against militants in Syria.
But let's be clear, there is no military solution to this issue. The action we are taking is part of a broader strategy, a political strategy, a diplomatic strategy, a humanitarian strategy. And in the end, the answer to what is happening in Iraq and in Syria is the same. We need good, strong governments that represent all of their people, Sunni, Shia, Kurd, Christian, and Druze. That is right for Iraq. It's right for Syria.
Mr. Cameron's remarks came after opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn decided his parliamentarians would be allowed to vote their conscience on the matter rather than to keep the party discipline and vote no. Human rights groups and opposition parties in Turkey are expressing concern about a multi-billion euro deal reached Sunday between Ankara and the European Union to stem migrant flows. Dorian Jones reports.
There is concern, especially among human rights groups, that the deal could be more about expediency than principle, says Andrew Gardner, Turkey researcher for Amnesty International.
We shouldn't shy away from criticism of Turkey on these issues, you know, with the aim of striking a deal with Turkey to prevent refugees coming to the EU.
Concerns over the deterioration of human rights in Turkey was a factor in why Ankara's bid had become frozen. Only days before Sunday's deal was struck, two prominent Turkish journalists were jailed for reporting on alleged government arms smuggling to Syria. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
The United Nations says overnight attacks on civilians by Ugandan rebels in an eastern border region of the Democratic Republic of Congo has left at least 24 people dead. Jury selection began Monday in the trial of the first of six Baltimore, Maryland police officers charged in connection with the death of a black man in police custody. The death set off days of rioting earlier this year amid heightened racial tensions. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Tuesday, the first day of December, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The African Union warns South Sudan warring parties of any further delays in implementing the August 26th peace agreement.
The African Union has been really concerned that moving forward to implement the agreement that was agreed to has not been smooth at all. And there has been a lot of blame game between the two parties, the government and the rebels.
Erastus Muecha is the deputy chair of the African Union Commission. A security drill at the Nairobi University is mistaken for a real terrorist attack. There have been mixed reactions in the Democratic Republic of Congo to President Kabila's call for a political dialogue. And African negotiators are confident of success at the climate change talks in Paris.
We're expecting that there will be some conclusion of the negotiations that started in Durban in 2011 towards a negotiated, legally binding agreement.
Bongani Majola is the spokesman for South African President Jacob Zuma. Chinese President Xi Jinping arrives in Zimbabwe today, Tuesday, for a historic visit and will examine election models for Somalia as that country prepares for presidential election next year. Those stories, plus Mark Oman's Post and Our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Election officials in Burkina Faso say former Prime Minister Roch Marc Christian Kabore has won the country's presidential election, becoming the country's first new president in decades. Authorities late Monday said Kabore, Prime Minister under former strongman Blaise Compaoré, before splitting with that regime, won the presidency in the first round with more than 53% of the vote. Provisional results show his closest rival, Zéphirin Diabré, with just under 30%. The French news agency reporting from the capital, Ouagadougou, said Diabré congratulated the victor at his party's headquarters shortly before the results were released. An African Union official says that the threat of sanctions remains for individuals obstructing the peace process in South Sudan. Erastus Muecha, deputy chair of the African Union Commission, calls on both the South Sudan government and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar to abide by the terms of the August 26 peace agreement. The rebels announced on Sunday that their advance team of 550 was to arrive in the South Sudan capital Juba today, Tuesday. But now there are concerns that due to logistical reasons, the delegation's arrival is being delayed. Muecha expressed cautious optimism about peace in South Sudan, but warns of any further delays.
The African Union has been really concerned that moving forward to implement the agreement that was agreed to has not been smooth at all. And there has been a lot of blame game between the two parties, the government and the rebels. But it's good news to hear that finally that is going to happen. But of course, we wait to see whether it happens. And as you know, the agreement had a number of components. First of all, to agree to a ceasefire. Then, of course, on the political side, form a government of national unity. But also look at things on the ground, particularly the refugees who have been suffering and the entire people of South Sudan who have really gone through horrendous challenges so that peace can return to Sudan and we can start to see normalcy return to South Sudan.
When I talk with them, I'm talking about security. What does the African Union know and what is to be done in terms of security in addition to the government in Juba?
On the part of security, there are several stages. The ceasefire and, of course, to enable the monitors gain access to both sides because they cannot move to those sides until the two sides open up for them to be able to go there and verify that the ceasefire is being observed. Then, of course, there is the integration of forces from either side. And, of course, the overall overarching agreement is for the political settlement.
There's been an African Union threat of possible sanctions against people who do not or who were contributing to delaying the peace process. What happens now? Would that threat still remain or what?
Yeah, the chairperson of the African Union Commission did issue a statement, and in her statement she indicated that Africa cannot continue to wait forever. In fact, sanctions, to be honest with you, it's been long overdue. Because don't forget that this crisis started way back in 2013, and they're still going on. And during this time, what we see is meeting after meeting, but not addressing the issues on the ground. But as we said, if you indicate that now they are ready to meet, and following that the mediation, as those who are providing mediation, for instance, the AU appointed mediator, former president of Botswana, is already on the ground, and other facilitators are also on the ground. So what we need now is to see really progress on the ground, and that's why there is this failed threat for sanctions.
Erastus Mwecha is the deputy chairman of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. A security drill at one of Kenya's prestigious universities on Monday turned chaotic as the students mistook it for a real terrorist attack. Reporter Mary Ann Yikobi of the Nation newspaper says a female employee died and 22 people wounded as students at Strathmore University in Nairobi jumped from as high as two-story buildings, frightened by gunfire.
There's this private university in Kenya called Strathmore University. It's one of the top universities that we have in the country. So following the wave of attacks that we've had in this country, the university thought it was good to have a security drill. So in the afternoon at around 2 p.m., the school management started shooting. I don't know, the guys who were conducting the security drill started shooting in the air. They had people running akin to an Al-Shabaab attack. So this threw the whole school into confusion, and students started running, jumping from first floor to others from third floor to the ground. So the whole thing was a mess. The whole drill looked like it just backfired on the management. At the end of it, all 20 students were actually injured. Two were rushed to the hospital. They were critically injured. In the evening of today, that is Monday, they lost a 33-year-old staff, a lady. And the school really has issued apologies, saying the security drill was something that they needed to do so they can know how well prepared the students are.
What happened? Did the school tell the students ahead of time that this security drill was going to take place, or it just happened?
It just happened. Just happened because from the way the students are talking, it's not like they had been sent an email or they had been forewarned or they had been told that this security drill is going to be conducted. So it's kind of like they were ambushed.
Who carried out this security drill? Was the Kenyan security people or this was university security?
I'm not sure about that, but they conducted it in conjunction with the OCPD. That's a police boss of the area, so the police bosses knew that a drill was going to happen. So when they were conducting it, the local security police chief were very much aware.
Does this mean that maybe people in Kenya are still on edge because of what took place at Garissa University?
Yeah, we are always on the edge. We are always very aware. Anytime you hear a blast or a bus tire or any loud noise akin to a gunshot, everyone takes to their heels. So we're still reeling from the shocks of the recent military attack. So we are always very alert. So that explains why the students were on a stampede and why they ran and they tried to save their lives. The memories are still fresh in our minds. And following the Paris attack, then I think that makes the whole situation worse. Yeah.
Mary Ann, thank you very much again for talking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, too.
Mary Egikobi is a reporter with the Nation newspaper of Kenya. She was speaking with me from the capital, Nairobi. Today's Tuesday, the first day of December, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Chinese President Xi Jinping arrives in Zimbabwe today, Tuesday, for a historic visit with a huge business delegation in what Harare says is a confirmation that the country's look east policy is beginning to bear fruit. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Service has details from Harare.
The streets of Harare have been swept clean, the country's best china polished, in anticipation of tomorrow's historic visit by the Chinese leader. According to Foreign Affairs Permanent Secretary Joy Bima, China and Zimbabwe will sign several deals worth millions of dollars in various sectors such as energy, transport, infrastructure development, construction, financing, culture, wildlife and agriculture. China is already funding several multi-million dollar projects in Zimbabwe, including the expansion of the Victoria Falls International Airport, the upgrading of Harare's water and sanitation system, and the expansion of the Kariba South Power Station. Mr. Xi will be making his first state visit to Zimbabwe, which last hosted the Chinese head of state in 1996. Political commentator Takura Jangaja tells Studio 7 Mr. Xi Jinping's visit is evidence that Harare's Look East policy is effective.
It's beyond the politics. It's essentially about business. The Chinese president is here to promote bilateral agreements, confirm them, and make sure that Chinese interests are not compromised by any other unfair or unclear political policy issues that may emerge going forward.
Harare businesswoman Tendai Anapiri says the visit by the Chinese leader and Chinese business people will present business opportunities for the Zimbabweans, adding Zimbabwean business people should be prepared to grab the opportunities.
You know, it's an international opportunity. So I'm resident in Zimbabwe, but I can have businesses outside Zimbabwe, but still be earning in Zimbabwe.
Former Zimbabwean ambassador to China and war veterans leader Christopher Mchangwa says the visit by the Chinese president will put the spotlight on Zimbabwe as a country which can attract foreign direct investment.
It will excite those Chinese who want to come to Zimbabwe to invest, to take advantage of our resource base, but our very smart minds. But more important, it also creates a competitive field where other capital markets begin to see Zimbabwe in a positive light.
China and Zimbabwe enjoy cordial relations which date back to the time of the liberation struggle, when China provided material and training for the liberation fighters. Over the years, the Asian country became Zimbabwe's key political and economic ally, preventing what Harare says was bullying of Zimbabwe by the West and blocking the imposition of sanctions by the United Nations, where it is a permanent member of the Security Council. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
There's been a mixed response from opposition parties and civil society in the Democratic Republic of Congo to President Joseph Kabila's call for a political dialogue to sort out election issues. The biggest opposition party has given the president's call a mild welcome, while other opposition parties have mostly rejected it. Nick Long has more from Kinshasa.
The DRC's biggest opposition party, the UDPS, does not appear to have issued a public communique in response to the president's call for a dialogue. But UDPS spokesman Augustin Kabuya told VOA a dialogue is needed to settle electoral issues, without which elections cannot take place.
Nous ne pouvons pas amener notre population à une élection.
He says we cannot lead the people into polls that will be doomed from the start. Everyone knows, he says, that no preparations have been made for the cycle of elections scheduled in 2016. And despite that, some people are saying, let us go straight to voting. Kabuya rejected accusations that the party plans to reach a power-sharing deal with President Kabila, allowing him to remain in power beyond his constitutional two-term limit, which ends in December next year. He asserted that his party's leader, Etienne Tshisekedi, was the real winner of the 2011 presidential elections, in which Tshisekedi officially finished second, and that it is therefore right for the UDPS to negotiate with Kabila. Kabuya says his party wants the elections to occur on time within Mr. Kabila's two-term limit, but for that to happen, they need to sit down and discuss electoral issues. The other two main opposition groupings, known as the G7 and the Opposition Dynamic, held a meeting Monday and issued a joint statement, read by Ingeli Ifoto of the Opposition Dynamic. The statement said Kabila's agenda for the dialogue, which includes discussing a change in the electoral system, clearly shows he intends to stay in office. It also accused his government of many failings.
Devant cette situation, qui nous reste-t-il encore? Sinon, le choix de nous lever.
Faced with this situation, Ingeli says there is no option left except to rise up and march.
Voilà pourquoi nous disons non au dialogue.
That is why, he says, we say no to the dialogue, no to a government of transition, no to a violation and change of the constitution, no to a referendum, no to the president hanging on to power, and yes to strict respect for the constitution. The president said civil society groups will be invited to the dialogue. A member of human rights group ASADHO, Jean-Claude Katende, told VOA that Kabila's agenda for the dialogue has increased their concern that he is thinking of changing the constitution. He said the agenda is aimed at introducing indirect presidential elections. Government spokesman Lambert Mende has said the president intends to respect the constitution. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Somalia is conducting national consultations to determine which model of election will be suitable for the country during next September's presidential election. The emerging consensus suggests that some regions prefer a repeat of the 2012 election model, which gave the traditional elders the power to select federal members of parliament who then elected the president. Abdi Ismail Sematar is a lecturer at the University of Minnesota and also a research fellow at the University of Pretoria. He says the parliament electing the president is a non-starter because most Somali members of parliament are corrupt.
The first one is that it's a non-starter. We have a government and a parliament and a sort of a cabinet that's premised on the 4.5 tribal formula. What it has done over the last 3 years, it has segmented and disabled the government and parliament to function properly by taking care of the interests of the national community, Somalis, the citizens of the country. And the trouble with that one is that the elders have been bought. Let's be very blunt and honest about it. So corruption, each seat is worth X number of dollars, $40,000, $50,000. And then the MPs who come as a product of that have been in the marketplace, financial marketplace, to sell their votes to the highest bidder for those candidates who want to become president and prime minister.
Yeah, what about the regions, the districts?
Yeah, the region. The regions, there is not a single region in which the populace have established full-fledged administrations. Take, for instance, Jubaland or Southwest or sort of the new one in sort of a Galmudug. There are no districts. They are nominal ones. So the people who are going to select MPs from there are the head honchos, sort of the governors of those regions. And they have less legitimacy than the elders who are sort of supposed to select MPs on the basis of 4.5. So that itself will, in fact, be less legitimate than even the 4.5 formula shepherded by the elders.
Is there a third way?
Yes, I think over the last few weeks, I have been hearing quite a bit from the sort of organized civil society and a number of political parties who have come together in Mogadishu and who have been working on producing an alternative. I have seen the print on that, and they have labeled it as the inclusive model for Somalia's 2016 election. What this does is to give a large number of stakeholders across the country a say in the selection of parliament. So one group will be the elders who will select not MPs, but who will select representative of communities, 40 individuals for every MP seat. And those 40 individuals will include youth, will include the clergy, if you like, the ulama, will include women, and will include sort of ordinary other citizens, responsible other citizens. So that will mean these individuals who have been selected to represent their communities in the order of about 10,000 people will be brought to Mogadishu in three secure locations. It will be relatively cheap. It will be much less expensive than the other options. And then political parties will be able to compete for the votes of those 10,000 people.
Abdi Ismail Sematar is a lecturer at the University of Minnesota and also a research fellow at the University of Pretoria. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of the US Somali Service. Africa's top climate change negotiators say they are confident they will get a legally binding agreement at this year's Paris climate change talks. But scientists say the temperature gap they seek is an estimate at best. And even senior negotiators from South Africa say they have not pinned down exactly how much money they want donors to put in to help developing countries adopt climate-friendly strategies. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
For months, African negotiators have repeated a sort of mantra as they prepared for climate change talks in Paris. Worldwide 2-degree temperature rise limit, binding agreement, financial help from developed nations. But as talks begin Monday in the cloudy French capital, negotiators from South Africa, the nation that has taken the lead for Africa in the talks, say while they are confident of success, they are still not entirely sure what it will look like. South Africa hosted the 2011 climate talks, which some experts say marked a turning point in the conversation by allowing poorer nations, like African nations, to have more of a say. Mongani Majola, a spokesman for President Jacob Zuma, explained from Paris.
We are expecting that there will be some conclusion of the negotiations that started in Durban in 2011 towards a negotiated legally binding agreement, by which we mean that all countries, big and small, will be bound by an agreement under the auspices of the United Nations that will limit their green gas emissions, and work towards a sustainable environment, but that they will also contribute to this sustainable environment with their technologies and finances.
One of the negotiators' demands is a cap on the average global temperature increase of more than 2 degrees Celsius, a threshold that scientists have identified as kind of a point of no return on climate change. But as scientist Agathe Maupin, a researcher at the Johannesburg-based South African Institute of International Affairs, explains, the science behind that is complicated. The 2-degree benchmark is merely an estimate. It could vary widely by location. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Uganda dismissed guest side Malawi 2-0 in quarterfinal action at the Council of East and Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia on Monday. Later, Ethiopia squeezed a 4-3 advantage in post-match penalty shootout to get past Tanzania mainland in the second quarterfinal. The two sides were deadlocked at 1-1 at the end of open play. Today, Tuesday, Rwanda challenged defending champions Kenya before South Sudan and Sudan clash in the other quarterfinals in Addis Ababa. In Senegal, South Africa play Zambia in Group A action at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Dakar today, Tuesday. Having lost their opening matches, both teams need a win to get their campaign back on track. This encounter will give way to the showdown between Tunisia and Senegal. Turning to athletics, Kenya's former world 10,000-meter champion Lynette Masai won the women's race at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Alcobendas, Spain on Sunday. Ethiopian Tamirat Tola won the men's race. Ugandan Timothy Toroitich was second ahead of Ethiopian Mukhtar Edris. Meanwhile, the IAAF Ethics Commission has suspended Athletics Kenya president Isaiah Kiplagat, Athletics Kenya vice president David Okeyo, and former Athletics Kenya treasurer Joseph Kinyua from all athletics activities for 6 months, the IAAF revealed in Monaco on Monday. According to the IAAF, the suspension is designed to facilitate investigations into allegations of corruption and doping cover-ups reported in a section of the British and German press. In basketball, Nigeria's Dolphins outwitted the Democratic Republic of Congo's Radi 68-57 at the Africa Women's Club Basketball Championships in Luanda, Angola on Monday. Angola's Primeiro de Agosto dismissed Cameroon's INJS 58-40, while Nigeria's First Bank beat Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority 87-71. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Election officials in Burkina Faso say former Prime Minister Roch Marc Christian Kabore has won the country's presidential election, becoming the country's first new president in decades. Authorities late Monday said Kabore, Prime Minister under former strongman Blaise Compaoré, before splitting with that regime, won the presidency in the first round with more than 53% of the vote. That's it for this Tuesday, December 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Marco Oman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butter saying, have a lovely day, Africa.
African music mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, after nearly 2 years of fighting the Ebola pandemic, Sierra Leone announced last month that the nation was Ebola-free. Guinean officials have declared that they will also soon be free of the virus. Join us Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Chaka Sali and his guests discuss the battle to completely end Ebola in West Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.